Scrolling for July 24th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We are back with another chapter of what is quickly becoming our favorite Sherlock Holmes story, The Valley of Fear. This chapter 4, Darkness.
Darkness. Oh, that's right. The Batman Darkness song from the Lego
no,
movie.
No, parents. Continue darkness.
And this starts in the middle of the night. This chapter begins in darkness.
Oh, yes.
At 3 a.m, the chief Sussex detective, obeying the urgent call from Sergeant Wilson of Burlstone, arrived from headquarters in a light dog cart behind a breathless trotter. By the 5:40 train in the morning, he had sent his message to Scotland Yard, and he was at the Burlstone station at 12 o'clock to welcome us. White Mason was a quiet, comfortable-looking person in a loose tweed suit, with a clean-shaved, ruddy face, a stoutish body, and powerful bandy legs adorned with gaiters, looking like a small farmer, a retired gamekeeper, or anything upon earth, except a very favorable specimen of the provincial criminal officer. I love this description of White Mason.
I'm a comfortable-looking person. Yeah, yeah. I feel like I look comfortable.
And I'm also going to point out, we're almost near the winter solstice. So days of darkness are very, very long during this time. And that was one of the things I also came away with, is that not only do we have darkness, but it is very long.
And, I mean, they've already said that the sun sets just before 4:30. Mm-hmm. So these are very short days indeed.
Mm-hmm. 24 hours.
Only 24, Steve.
I make that joke every time Chip brings
Thank
up the solstices. He's like, this is the longest day of the year. I say, yeah, 24 hours. Every day's 24 hours.
Yeah. If you don't leave your basement, it doesn't make much
it's
of a
difference. It's the same. It's all the same down here. I don't know the difference.
It's always dark or always light, depending upon the light switch.
It's all exactly the same.
But if you have a moat and a drawbridge, the length of your day matters because you put down your drawbridge at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Steve.
We get to some more of this case. Boy, Doyle is really laying out this case really well for us in Chapter 4. Holmes and Watson arrive in Sussex. They get the lowdown before they go to the house.
And of course, I love how Holmes is described here. So MacDonald made an occasional note while Holmes sat absorbed with the expression of surprised and reverent admiration with which the botanist surveys the rare and precious bloom. And I think here, he's not absorbed by the police officer telling the situation. He's like, ooh, this is a good mystery. This is a good case. Remarkable, he said when the story was unfolded. Most remarkable. I can hardly recall any case where the features have been more peculiar. I thought you would say so, Mr. Holmes, said White Mason in great delight. We're well up with the times in Sussex. He's like, you might think we're this little country parsonage, but we got good stuff here. We got great murders. This is a great case. Lots of features to interest someone of your stature. He's like really proud of his case.
The schools are good too. So if you wanted to move to Sussex, you could have good schools and good murders.
And great pictures. Those white cliffs always are so photogenic.
It's no America though. Doyle really, boy oh boy, does he love the idea of America.
Well, he certainly has an idea of what America's like, Steve. And Pam, it certainly is a unique time.
I love the references to America, for example, about the American shotgun. No doubt it is an American shotgun. I seem to have read that a sawed-off shotgun is a weapon used in some parts of America. Apart from the name upon the barrel, the idea had occurred to me. There is evidence, then, that this man who entered the house and killed its master was an American. And then...
Sure, that's how that works, right?
Well, that's because, you know, it's a sawed-off shotgun. That's... I have heard no evidence yet that any stranger was ever at the house at all. The open window, the blood on the sill, the queer card, the mark of the boots, in the corner, the gun. They certainly want to line up everything that could be possibly, that possibly could be our evidence here.
Yeah, they're still debating whether this was a suicide or an inside job or if there was a stranger. And MacDonald goes, I haven't seen any evidence that it was a stranger. And Holmes goes, no, look at all this stuff.
And then, and basically with the gun and all those things, he goes, you don't need to import an American from outside in order to account for American doings. There you go. Tell us more about that, Mr. Doyle.
And I love that McDonald says that Mr. Douglas was an American or had lived long in America.
Close enough.
He's actually British, but he did live there long enough that he could have acquired the habit of sawed-off shotguns.
Well, that's how we run our lives here.
This is all we need to do is check the news.
Just check the news.
Yeah, welcome to Chicago. I'm surprised this isn't a Chicago connection, actually.
Isn't there? There may be.
There may be.
We'll see. Pam knows. She's not telling.
I think it's Pennsylvania, actually.
Yeah, it's that's like that.
The Pennsylvania, the Chicago of the East.
is that what they say?
Well, that's what Chicagoans would say.
McDonald is such a character here. His Aberdeen accent gets stronger as he gets more passionate, and we get some dialect writing here from Doyle, which is wonderful.
Groundskeeper Willie here from The Simpsons.
He is from Aberdeen. Yes, that is the right accent that you have in your head, Chip. The ring business and the card point to premeditated murder for some private reason. Very good. Here is a man who slips into a house with deliberate intention of committing murder. He knows, if he knows anything, that he will have a difficulty. There's D-E-E-E, difficulty, which totally went into vampire.
Yes.
in my default accent. A difficulty in making his escape, as the house is surrounded with water. What weapon would he choose? You would say the most silent in the world. Then he could hope with the deed was done to slip quickly from the window, to wade the moat, and to get away at his leisure. That's understandable. Understandable! But is it understandable that he should go out of his way to bring with him the most noisy weapon he could select, knowing well that it will fetch every human being in the house to the spot as quickly as they can run, and that it is all odds that he will be seen before he gets across the moat?
And for our listeners who not really can't see Steve is wearing a kilt and he has his tartan on.
And so for those ready. Of us, our listeners who aren't enjoying this, I know why.
Always playing the character.
He's got so many lines in this. He's such the central character of this chapter. So the question of timing becomes very interesting here. There is some very deep clues about the timing of this case. The gun was wired to fire both barrels simultaneously. That's not an easy thing to do. That took some time, for sure.
That's American right there.
Overkill. That's what it is. It is overkill. Like, why would somebody do that? Right? Yes. Mr. Douglas had left Mrs. Douglas moments before the gunshot was heard throughout the house. There was only a few moments where this all took place. The candle in the room confirms that. It was only lit for a few minutes. So Holmes goes into a whole litany of what had to happen at this moment. The ring was removed at some point. They're debating whether it was before the guy died or after. And the household rushed to the sound of the gun and got there within, a minute or so. So the perpetrator, who left muddy boot prints, blood on the windowsill, was not seen by anyone in this very, very quick motion.
Yeah, and it's set up as like just a really, really great mystery. So many questions. And then I really love when Inspector McDonald says, I have worked with Mr. Holmes before. He plays the game. My own idea of the game, at any rate, said Holmes with a smile. I go into a case to help the ends of justice and the work of the police. If I have ever separated myself from the official force, it is because they have first separated themselves from me. I have no wish ever to score at their expense. At the same time, Mr. White Mason, I claim the right to work in my own way and give my results at my own time, complete rather than in stages. So Holmes is not willing to really comment on this. Like in this chapter, he's asking for what other people think, but he doesn't give anything away. I also really like that by this point in 1914 or 15, playing the game, that's like an actual thing that people do with Holmes, right? Is pretend he's real. And so Doyle is actually nodding to this lovely game that we Sherlock Holmes scholars and fans still play today, of pretending that Holmes is a historical figure rather than a fictional one.
And in those circles, it is referred to as the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Watson notes here, very much following up with the initial description of White Mason, that Holmes really likes this country police officer. And Watson says, he impressed me, this country specialist. He had a solid grip of fact and a cool, clear, common sense brain, which should take him some way in his profession. Holmes listened to him intently, with no sign of that impatience which the official exponent too often produced. We might even say which Watson himself sometimes produces, right?
Sure.
And he's a comfortable looking person.
And
which I'm still not sure what that means.
You do he's know smart. What it means.
He's smart and he looks comfortable. Those are nice shoes.
He's wearing Skechers, Steve.
Skechers for the win. I win again. The four of them continue to clarify this case because, boy, there's a lot of case in Chapter 4, isn't there?
So why would you use a sawed-off shotgun, the loudest weapon imaginable, when you then have to, like, wade through a moat? Where is the wet guy who walked through, like, 3 feet of water? Why is the wedding ring gone? Because that seems really hard to either take off someone's wedding ring after you shot them or force them to remove it themselves with the other ring that goes back on. And then what does that weird card that says VV341? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. And so Mac lays out his reasons for thinking the murderer was part of the household. We kind of know what he means by that. He means Cecil Barker, right? Who's the American? Who's the other American in the household? Holmes says, very interesting, but just a little unconvincing.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it would be absolute nonsense if it wasn't that anything else is even worse, cried MacDonald. So they all understand that they don't really have a good way to think about this. And then as we approach the end of the chapter, Mac tells us that that queer card, the VV341, it gives the impression of a secret society of some sort. The same with his badge upon the forearm. So don't forget this guy has a brand, right, on his arm. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting to bring up the secret society idea.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, doesn't Holmes respond where that card and the brand are both to be a signal that a newspaper reporter would put in there to give an idea that, you know, anybody who read that story would know that
yes.
something was taking place.
Secret societies and codes go together, huh?
Yes. And then there are two other little details that get brought to our attention as we're moving towards the end of this chapter. First of all, Mr. Douglas cut himself shaving yesterday. Ooh, very unusual, says Holmes. Was he nervous about something? So that's detail number one. And then the second one, and full disclosure, I have a published article on this story, and it's The Case of the Metafictional Dumbbell, because I love this detail of the dumbbell, which is going to come back, so forgive me, but this is one of my favorite moments. So Holmes says, what's this under the side table? Mr. Douglas's dumbbells, said Ames, who's the butler. Dumbbell, there's only one. Where's the other? I don't know, Mr. Holmes. There may have only been one. I have not noticed them for months. One dumbbell, Holmes said seriously, but his remarks were interrupted by a sharp knock at the door. So he was about to tell us something about the importance of the dumbbell, and then knock, knock, knock. Hey, it's Clive. And they just found the bicycle.
Oh, so, you know, Watson was there, so wasn't there officially two dumbbells?
Oh.
Was that in your paper? Was that in your published paper that
No. And mine? Of course, of course.
That's, oh, that, in Chip's, that, in Chip's published work, yes.
Right. It was never peer-reviewed. No, it was just me. In fact, it's just...
Chip's reviewed on a peer.
Oh, that's right. No, 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 no. It was not the same. It was a Word document that, you know, I never released. But my own journal.
So, yes, we have the expert with us, Chip, and she knows what's going to happen, and we don't, and this is fascinating to me.
Well, so this last clue that we end up getting is very interesting. But as I'm reading this, I can't help but think this is an inside job. So anyway, there's my Watson prediction, which is
just, the butler. Well, you think the butler did it?
Possibly. I'm just a simpleton.
One of the other six people who work in the house who are never named and are immediately dismissed.
Well, who knows? Who knows, Steve? But I can't help. I can't help but think that based on the clues that we're given, that but I mean the bicycle seems interesting. They don't have. They
don't gave it away. Spoilers.
Why?
We haven't gotten to the bicycle yet.
Well, I was also thinking the hot air balloon is never mentioned. So
that's a totally different mystery.
Go ahead.
So, yes, Chip, you're right. There's one last clue that we haven't gotten to yet, and that is a bicycle, just like Doyle enjoys.
Yes, we get so many bicycles in the last part of the canon. So, it would be a grand help to the police, said the inspector. Now we're at the ending of the chapter, if these things were numbered and registered. But we must be thankful for what we've got. If we can't find where he went to, at least we are likely to get where he came from. But what in the name of all that is wonderful made the fellow leave it behind? And how in the world has he got away without it? We don't seem to get a gleam of light in the case, Mr. Holmes. Don't we? My friend answered thoughtfully. I wonder. End of chapter. So, Sherlock Holmes, we can tell, he's got a lot of things going on. The guy hasn't shaved. There's this dumbbell. He left his bicycle behind. Sherlock Holmes has got some ideas, we're pretty sure.
We had a couple references to some products, and I find that these are the little cues that they throw out there to kind of make it real. In this chapter, we get Pennsylvania Small Arms Company, and I had to look that up to see if that was a real company, and it doesn't look like it is. It was made up, but it sounds real. So, once again, this idea that, that Doyle wants to give us this idea that this is a real-world event.
Is that your PSA, Chip?
Yes. And of course, it was
Pennsylvania Small Arms.
Yes, that's right. Then we have the Rudge Whitworth bicycle that is mentioned in there. That is a real company. That is one of the bicycle companies that was producing during that time. Eventually, they go on to produce motorcycles. And what they're really known for is these spoke wheels that if you've seen some of the British sports cars, they've got these spoked wheels and... Yeah, that would be this company.
Very fancy, those spoked wheels.
Exactly. They are very fancy. Yeah. When you got that racing green or that racing red and these fancy wheels going on there. But the bicycle, this Rudge Whitworth, is a real company. And in 1894, they certainly were producing bicycles at that time.
Chapter 4, brought to you by Rudge Whitworth. You know, those wheels.
Those wheels.
Well, and we also got reference to the fact that Watson writes down Sherlock's stories, right? So there's a moment where White Mason says, I'm sure we are honored by your presence and to show you all we know. Come along, Dr. Watson, and when the time comes, we'll all hope for a place in your book. Which, of course, he got. That wish was granted because we are reading all about him in this. And so
nice. 100
there's
years
something
later.
Really fun about that product placement as well.
Mm-hmm.
Pam, can we come back tomorrow and read some more?
I think we'd better.
We're getting to that point, aren't we? We're getting to that point where we really are anticipating and really want to read the next chapter as quickly as possible. But we're going to stick to our daily schedule. We're going to wait till tomorrow. But can you imagine waiting a month for
Terrible.
This next chapter?
Torture, Steve. Torture.
I think Doyle is really doing well at writing the chapters of this story. And I think if I was buying this monthly in a magazine, I would be ready to give them money for chapter 5.
Definitely.
Yeah. This is good stuff. I hope everybody out there is enjoying it as much as we are, and we would love to hear from you. We had a little bit of chatter on Twitter this morning that I'll share with you later. But we would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Send us a voicemail. How are you doing? How are you doing? I went New York on that. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations that are almost done with the whole canon. Almost. Join us tomorrow as we get into chapter 5. We don't have to wait a month like the people in 1914 had to. So we are ready for chapter 5. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflam.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fiends.